The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Debbie has done a remarkable job as chairman of the Democratic Party. Now, I can tell you from firsthand experience how tough that is, because when Will Rogers said, "I belong to no organized party, I'm a Democrat," he was telling the truth. It's like herding cats trying to be chair of the Democratic National Committee. But Debbie's done a wonderful job. She's been a great spokesman for the party. She's been aggressive when she needed to be aggressive. She's been conciliatory when she needed to be conciliatory. She's just projected a great image. She's been a terrific fundraiser. And she's worked with the state parties all over the country to build up the state parties and build up our capabilities for doing the type of field work that really was responsible for the 2012 election victory. She's been a great chairman. She's been a great congressman. And she wrote this book, and this is a remarkable book. I read it, and then, as you may notice, if you've bought the book, I wrote a little blurb for the back. It's a remarkable book for three reasons. One, it's a great vindication of what we believe, that government can and should make a difference in people's lives. Not that it can do everything, but it can be a catalyst for protecting our most vulnerable citizens, for creating opportunity, and doing the things that are necessary to make sure we have a just and fair society. It's a great tome about that, and it's very convincing. Secondly, it charts out the progressive agenda for the future. And it charts it out in a way that's compelling. I mean, the term progressive covers a broad amount of territory. But what it means is people who believe that we can do better, that government can again be a force for good, that we can create a fairer and just society, even in this great country of ours. It is, as I said in the blurb, as good a foundation for the progressive agenda of the future as anything I've read it in any book published anywhere. But what really marks this as a remarkable book is how Debbie shows how her experiences inform what she is today and her views for tomorrow. It's a great life story and how Debbie's life has shaped her progressive views. She's a great, great leader for us. She'll be an important person on the scene of American politics for decades to come. It's an honor to have her in Philadelphia. And I'm not just being nice to her because we want the convention. And she will have a little bit to say about the convention. I would have said this anyway. So everyone, let's give a big Philadelphia welcome to Congresswoman Deborah Fitz.
Now I see what he means.
It's working.
Okay, it's working. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Governor. It is really an honor to have been invited here by you. You should know that there's no concern at all that that the interest, the passing interest that that folks in Philadelphia have in hosting the Democratic National Convention had anything to do with this invitation. He extended the invitation long before. In fact, when we first talked about my book and I asked him to give me the honor of him reviewing it, the first thing that Governor Rendell suggested was that when you go on your book tour, when you start talking about why you wrote this book, you have to go to the Philadelphia Free Library. And so I've been anticipating and looking forward to joining you for months now, and I'm so glad to be able to be here and to have had Ed Rendell write a blurb for the back of the book and talk about the importance of it and the you urge people to read it if you want a sense of the direction that, at least from my point of view, the country should go, and probably just a hunch, the direction that one or two of you in the audience think we should go as well, was really just an incredible honor. I have cheered Ed Rendell, you know, from my couch for many, many years, you know, all the way from the time I was in the state legislature to now as a member of Congress, and And then have had the privilege many times of tag teaming with him, as I was telling him I so enjoy on MSNBC when we take on whoever it is that is on the other side of the argument from us. I'll be a diplomat and just put it that way. So thank you so much. I really appreciate the very kind introduction and how incredibly committed you remain to making sure that as Democrats, although I'm not going to only talk from a Democratic perspective this evening, but how as Democrats we really believe that government can be part of the solution and is not all of the problem. And you articulate that so effectively on TV, really, you know, regularly. So thank you so much, Governor. Thank you for your service. Thank you. So thank you all for being here this evening. It really is my pleasure to talk to you for a few minutes, and then, as the governor and I both agreed, the Q&A is always a lot more fun and interesting for all of us. But to talk to you for a few minutes about why, when I thought about it and realized that as a mom of three young kids, some of you may or may not know, I have twin 14-year-olds, a boy and a girl, and a 10-year-old girl, the lights of my life. So obviously that's my first responsibility. And then, of course, I represent my incredible constituents who've given me the privilege of representing them in our nation's capital in South Florida. And by the way, let me just make sure you know that you should care about two people that represent you, the person that represents you in Congress now, and me, because I'm going to represent you when you retire and move to South Florida in 20 years. So I'm looking forward to representing you in about a generation, if not sooner. So I have that responsibility professionally. And then, of course, about 3 years ago, President Obama, actually 3 years ago next weekend, April 5th, 2011, I got a call from President Obama asking me to watch his back and help bring him across the finish line and take on the challenge of chairing the Democratic National Committee. And the only thing I'll disagree with you on, Governor, is that I think Will Rogers would agree that we are an organized political party today. And if you look at the success that we've had over the last number of years, we really essentially won five of the last six presidential elections, and we have had success all across the country. So, of course, it's my job to say that, but I would think Will Rogers would be proud today. So I have a lot of balls in the air. And when I thought about whether or not it was time for me to write a book, the only way that the answer was yes was if I could share my perspective through the lens that I look through every day, which is as my children's mother. And I realized when I gave birth to my kids 14 years ago, that at that moment, and every parent will tell you that the epiphany that they have once they become a parent for the first time, and you know everyone will tell you, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, but you know everyone prepares you, and your friends who have had kids before you tell you, you know, just wait till you have kids, your whole perspective changes, and you think you know. You think, oh, of course I know that. I totally understand. Of course it will. Well, you don't really know until you actually become a parent. And then it's like your life does a 180. And for me, I realized that from that moment on, every decision I made was made through the lens of being my children's mother. And that was every professional decision, every personal decision. And since I was already elected, it was really so transformational for me, not just personally, but professionally as well, because I already had decided to run for office originally to make the world a better place and to help make other people's lives better. But and also, of course, to go to bat for my constituents' families and their children. But it becomes much more personal when you have kids, and the ramifications of the decisions that are made or not made impact your own children. So I wanted to write for the next generation because we reached, I thought, a critical time of what I think is crisis proportions, because we have so many important, significant issues that have essentially stalled, that if we don't make some of these significant decisions now, which are you know, monumental, cataclysmic, that would require Herculean effort, then it is going to dramatically impact my children, your children, the children of the families that I represent in South Florida and all across this country for generations. And so when I decided to write the book, it was to try to issue a wake-up call, to try to get not people who already get it and who are already involved in some way and understand that they need to do something to make a difference in the lives of their own lives and the lives of others, but to try to write a roadmap, a way for, and I know so many of my own friends and neighbors and family members and constituents who aren't political and who want to make a difference and know that there's something, an issue, education, healthcare, climate change, women's rights, civil liberties, gun safety, pick the issue. Everybody doesn't care about every single issue, but there are issues that grab people. And they don't know how to begin. They don't know where to begin because the issue seems so significant that it's hard to wrap their minds around how to make a difference. So I wrote For the Next Generation to try to show people that if they read the book, even if they didn't read it cover to cover and only picked out a few chapters, that we could give them a sense of how to get involved and make a difference on that issue. And knowing that I know I have a lot of balls in the air that I'm trying to hold up at once, and knowing, you know, that people have families that they have to focus on, and sometimes it's tough to get out of your own way, never mind add another thing to do. Knowing that when people close the book and think, okay, I really do want to make a difference, but I'm not sure where to begin, at the end of the book, I put a list of every organization and how to contact that organization at the end of the book so that operationally people could go to that list and say, okay, I want to get involved in Planned Parenthood. And there's the contact information right there. There's the website. And they could act immediately. And I also wanted to show people, and this is something that I did when I was a university instructor before I was elected to Congress, I wanted to show people how public policy decisions impact their lives personally and professionally, and how they could make a difference on that, on a particular public policy issue. And let me just ask you a question. I want to just do a survey. How many of you, raise your hand if you've ever signed a petition? Okay. And how about if you've ever attended a town hall meeting? Okay, a little bit fewer hands. How about sat down and written an email in your own words to an elected official? Okay, very motivated, active group. Okay, well, good. I'm really glad. Or picked up the phone and called an elected official. How many of you at a town hall meeting have stayed after the meeting, gone up to the podium, and spent a few minutes talking to the elected official who was hosting the meeting? Many, many fewer hands. Okay, so the petition gatherers are not going to be very happy with me when I suggest this to you, but don't sign any more petitions. The advice that I would give you tonight is that if you want to make a difference on an issue, the person who is the target of your communication is influenced by, really directly, the amount of time that you have spent on that communication. So in other words, I and my fellow elected officials know that your most important resource, some people think it's money. The other side of the aisle often thinks the most precious resource that people have is money. We know in our party that the most precious resource that you have is your time. So how many times when you've signed a petition has it been with a petition gatherer who's shoved a clipboard in your hand outside a supermarket and they've described what the petition says to you, and you don't read it, you just say, of course, I support saving the whales, and you sign the petition. So I know that. I know the chances that you actually read the whole petition are very, very small because people just want to get to their cars and move on to the next thing. And as a result, when a petition with thousands of signatures is plopped on our desk or sent over to our office or even emailed, we know that you probably didn't spend much of that precious resource of yours on that particular communication. But if you sat down at your computer and typed an email in your own words, not just added your name and address to an organizational mass email, then you've taken the time to think about the issue and why it matters to you, spend that time communicating how best to let me know that that issue is important to you, and then sent it off. And even better if you've actually written a handwritten letter. So when it comes to, because we all have precious little time, when it comes to whether or not you're going to try to make a difference with an elected official, make sure it's the form of communication that has taken you some time and come close to putting it in your own words. But when you attend a town hall meeting, even better, and this is, I know this is very practical advice, you know, rather than, you know, 30,000 foot pie in the sky type stuff, but this is the kind of this is the kind of thing that to folks who aren't very engaged in the political process, they really don't realize. So I can't tell you how many times, and Governor, I'm sure this has happened to you, that the people that stay after a town hall meeting and talk to me at the podium come up and give me the most amazing idea or tell me about a problem that I never thought of. And I've turned that into legislation that ultimately has become law. And so that one encounter, that extra few minutes that you spent trying to make a difference on the issue that mattered to you, you spent the time, and I have the time at that podium after the meeting is finished. So I hoped in this book to try to give people tools that they could utilize that would, A, prevent them from wasting a lot of time, and B, that they could have the maximum impact when it comes to how they can affect an issue that mattered to them. So I want to just actually read you one section of the book, talk for another couple minutes, and then just get into some dialogue. Because we're in a time right now that I've never seen before. You know, even as the chair of the Democratic National Committee, one thing I know, especially because I believe so strongly that government can make a difference and it can be a catalyst for change in people's lives and isn't all of the problem, as too many of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle believe now. One thing that is so critical, even as the chair of the DNC, that we can't engage in my way or the highway politics. That has to stop. You know, I know that I'm not always right. Don't tell my husband I said that. But I know that I'm not always right. It doesn't always have to be my way. And we don't right now have enough people on the other side of the aisle that aren't dug in, that even think of the people on the other side of the negotiating table, Democrats, as being legitimate leaders. I mean, so the difference, I've been in office for 22 years, going on 22 years. And of all the years I've been in a legislative body, the State House in Florida, the State Senate, and now in Congress, about 13 of those years I've been in the minority. So as a liberal Democrat who's not afraid to say it out loud, I have always needed to find a way, in order to be effective, to reach across the aisle, build relationships, and make sure that I can win someone over who probably starts out thinking they don't want to help me at all, and they are sure they're not going to agree with anything I tell them. So that's just been the process. And, you know, you get engaged in give and take, you sit down, you work through things, and sometimes you're going to win someone over and sometimes you won't. But you sit down and you consider the person you're negotiating with a legitimate actor. Unfortunately, with the advent of the Tea Party and the Republicans engaged in what has essentially become a civil war, and the Tea Party has been allowed to win that civil war, the my way or the highway politics that they've embraced so tightly has turned into a situation where they don't think of Democrats as just being the opposition. We're the enemy. And we're not just wrong on an issue. We're liars. I mean, if just look, follow my Twitter feed for 5 minutes, and you'll see what I mean. There are a whole lot of haters out there. And the invective and the vitriol and the mean-spiritedness that is directed not at me. I've got the skin of an alligator now, so it, you know, it doesn't affect me personally at all. But it also doesn't contribute to a constructive dialogue that will get us to the point that we need to be on so many of these issues. So that's why I wrote the book. But I want to read from the beginning of the conclusion, ironically, to give you a sense of why I'm here. The conclusion is titled, Change, What Happens Next is Up to Us. Over the course of our lives, each of us has moments of clarity, when we know exactly what matters above all else. That flash of insight gives us a sense of purpose. And in that moment, we have the capacity to reorganize our lives so that virtually every decision we make from that point forward serves that overarching purpose. In my own life, there have been two such moments, giving birth to my children and being diagnosed with breast cancer. One was exhilarating. The other was devastating. But both of these events made me realize that I absolutely must make the most of my opportunity to have an impact on what matters most to me while on this earth, sharing whatever knowledge and skills I have for making it a better place. That had always been my mission in life, but when I had children, this mission came into sharper focus, becoming more urgent than ever before. My husband and I brought into the world three babies who depended on us completely and who we could not imagine living without, meaning that we were dependent on them as well. Caring for those children immediately became the most important thing in our lives, and with that came a sense of vulnerability. This is why my breast cancer diagnosis gave me such a dreadful jolt. Even though my doctors were confident that the disease could be defeated through aggressive treatment, I knew how pernicious cancer could be. There was no guarantee that I would survive, and no guarantee that it wouldn't come back if I beat it. All the experiences I imagined having with my children, all that I wished to teach them and do for them, all of that was in jeopardy. At the same time, I learned that I was not alone. There was a sisterhood of women whose lives had been interrupted just like mine had, who felt the same fear about the future. Women like Mae McCarmo, who was only 32 when she received her own breast cancer diagnosis in 2006. Mama's daughter was 3 years old at that time. With her breast cancer at stage two, Mama didn't know whether she would live long enough to see her daughter go to kindergarten, much less graduate from high school and college. In the midst of a grueling chemotherapy regimen, Mama promised God that if she was given the strength she needed to outlast the disease, she would devote her life to helping other young women battle breast cancer. Mama won her battle, and then she made good on her promise by creating the Tiger Lily Foundation. Even before my own diagnosis, I had always been a proponent of breast cancer research and awareness. But when I developed breast cancer, that work became even more important to me. In 2009, after I shared my own breast cancer experience publicly, I teamed up with Mama and her foundation to craft legislation that directed the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to launch a national education campaign designed to raise awareness of breast cancer in young women. That bill, called the Early Act, was incorporated within the Affordable Care Act that passed into law in March of 2010, thanks in large part to a diverse coalition of more than 40 organizations who rallied in support of the bill. Today, the Early Act Task Force at the CDC, through appropriations passed as part of the Early Act, have awarded grants to organizations like Sharsheret and FORCE, which help younger women deal with the unique challenges that they face when diagnosed with breast cancer. The Early Act Task Force will be creating a national education and awareness campaign targeted at young women so they are more likely to catch breast cancer early and survive. Taking these actions, knowing that I had a role in helping future girls and women prevent breast cancer, was incredibly empowering. With the help of Mama and other breast cancer activists, we managed to turn personal adversity into universal good. Every person has the capacity to empathize with others and to be their champion. For instance, not all of us have children, but all of us were children at one time, so we can understand the consequences of decisions made by adults responsible for children's well-being. We must recognize our responsibility and our obligation to make decisions in a way that will improve children's welfare. Similarly, not all of us will receive a cancer diagnosis, but we will all have to come to terms with our own mortality. When that day comes, we will face the question of whether we did enough during our lives to make a difference in the lives of others. Having considered that question myself, I can say that there is no room for doubts or regrets. Each of us must be able to answer that universal question by saying that he or she absolutely has made a positive impact on the world. We cannot fool ourselves. We must truly believe this. And we cannot afford to postpone the purpose that defines our lives because we don't know how long we have. For the sake of our children, for our fellow human beings, and for the tranquility of our own individual souls, we must begin to take action right now. So, growing up around my very Jewish family dinner table, as a secular Jew, and I get the sense that there's probably a few mishpucha in the audience, just a hunch. but growing up around my family dinner table, even as a secular Jew, my parents really instilled in my brother and I that it was incredibly important that because we were fortunate, that we embraced the notion of tikkun olam, repairing the world, and that because we were fortunate, it was our responsibility to give back to our community and help make the world a better place. And I like to say that I made tikkun olam a career choice. And really took that to heart. And so I made public service a career choice, and one that I think was a noble choice that has given me the thrill and the honor of being able to be in the trenches every single day, fighting on behalf of my own community, but also going to bat and amplifying the voice of people whose voices need amplification, or simply being a voice for people who don't have one. And that's what this book was all about. It covers a wide range of topics. It was really a 3-year labor of love, one that was worth every minute, and that has brought me to you today. And so thank you so much for joining me, and look forward to talking with you for a little while. Thank you. Thank you. Wait, I see what you mean.
My name is Andy. I'm director of author events here. The way this works is raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the mic. Please ask your question in the form of a question. Gentleman off to our right here. Sir, would you please wait for the microphone?
The Affordable Care Act has been, the exchanges have been open for 6 months. They've enrolled about 6 million people. They've enrolled more in Medicaid. They have had great effects on pre-existing conditions, and the polls show that only a small percentage, less than 20% of the people, want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and not replace it. And actually, there's a majority who think it's a good idea. Now, if this is the case, why are so many Democrat politicians running away from it and not standing behind it?
Thank you for your question. Thank you for accurately describing the circumstances around the Affordable Care Act. By the way, if you know anyone who does not have coverage, there is still time, 4 hours, to be covered this year. You can go on healthcare.gov. Let people know that they can still go on healthcare.gov. And if they have begun the sign-up process, and quite frankly, if they've had any trouble at all, and given that the website had a few issues because of all the people on the website today, there is an extended enrollment period that will allow people to continue to enroll for a little while still. But we actually, I bet we're going to be nearer to, if not more than, 7 million people by the time all is said and done, which was the original projections that CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, said was what was needed. So I think we're going to get there. And you're right. You have the majority of Americans who don't want to go back to a broken healthcare system, who don't think we should repeal it. And that's one of the things in the healthcare chapter of the book. I talk about my own personal story. I mean, just to give you a sense. I mean, after. I was diagnosed with breast cancer a little more than six years ago at 41 after a clean mammogram. And, you know, fortunately, I knew what was normal for me. So I knew when something felt different and was able to get myself right to a doctor. Didn't have to, you know, do any hand-wringing. There was a problem. I went to the doctor. But do you know how many women have shared with me since I shared my own experience? Because I actually, in 2008, didn't share my experience while I was going through it. I dealt with it privately. It was really important to me. My children were 4 and 9, so cancer is pretty scary for little kids, and I thought that was best for them. But so many women, since I have shared my own story publicly, have come up to me and said that they knew there was a problem, but they had too big a copay, too big a deductible, were worried that it was cancer or that something was wrong, and didn't go to the doctor. Or they had a recommendation from their doctor to either have chemo and radiation, but had to pick which one they were going to go through because they couldn't afford the copay or deductible on both. Or simply weren't able to go to the doctor at all, even though they knew there was a problem, because they didn't have coverage. There's 129 million people who live in this country with a pre-existing condition, not including the women in this country who, just by being women, were a walking pre-existing condition, according to insurance companies, that now have the peace of mind as of January 1st that they can go to the doctor when they're sick. They don't have to make horrific choices that, you know, would compromise their health and their lives. And your question is specific, and I'm going to answer it specifically. I don't really see a lot of Democrats, as you describe, running from the Affordable Care Act. Now, there are some that have very understandably said, look, there's been problems with the implementation as we've started to roll out. It's a major change. You know, we don't totally reform something as significant as healthcare in this country by flipping a light switch and thinking everything is going to work perfectly. Just like the implementation of lots of other major changes in law through the years. And, of course, we don't expect that we're going to have to fight off 51 attempts and counting to repeal those very major changes when they have problems. We sit down and we work together across the aisle to solve those problems and make sure that it's implemented smoothly. I'll give you a perfect example. When we implemented Medicare Part D, the prescription drug coverage that all but three Democrats actually voted against because of the way it was structured when George W. Bush was president, when it was passed into law and about to be implemented, Democrats didn't try to repeal it. We didn't try to scuttle it. We all did our best to make sure we could get the word out. I held town hall meeting after town hall meeting for my seniors to make sure they understood exactly what they needed to do to sign up. Not so the Republicans. They're doing everything they can to throw obstacles in the path. And amazingly, in spite of all the obstacles that the Republicans have thrown in states across the country and the 51 repeal votes or votes to significantly change it, there are still 7 million people who have signed up for coverage. And that's remarkable. So I think Democrats are doing what they should do. You know, call out the problems when they see them. And the Democrats that I know, there isn't a single Democrat that's called for repeal. The Democrats that I know are doing exactly what they should do, which is saying, hey, if as there are problems, we should sit down and work them out. And, you know, the Republicans are doing the opposite, and I think that's going to be to their peril in November.
Another question. Lady in blue on the aisle here, and then there's a gentleman with his hand up in the sweater.
How do we bring back civility in politics? You know, an example today, when I was listening to the news, there was a United States senator who said that 6 million is a cook, they're cooking the books. There can't possibly be this many. And it goes to your point about saying that there are lies. How do we get the news? First of all, I was mad at MSNBC for even covering this person, United States Senator, who made this comment. We shouldn't even be talking about people like this. But how do we bring back civility? And what's the answer?
I'm really glad you asked that question. I actually have a chapter on civility in the book because it is, to me, such a critical issue. Like I said, even as the chair of the DNC, I realize that the other side's point of view does have some value. I don't agree with a lot of what the Republicans stand for, but I have been able to reach across the aisle and work with colleagues who are Republicans to find common ground. And you have to make an effort. You have to be willing. You have to consider that there is some validity to their opinion and that they are legitimately elected by their own constituents. And as a result, to get anything done and to make progress, we have to work together. To that end, one of the things that I've done is, and I talk about this in the book as well, hosted with no fanfare or attention on it at all, bipartisan dinners in Washington with a colleague of mine, Dan Webster from Florida, who was my speaker when I was in the state legislature. And I mean, when I tell you, you couldn't put together two more opposite individuals than me and Dan Webster. But we really both believe in civility. We both believe in being able to work together. We were able to work together in the legislature on a number of different things. You know, not on the big stuff. That was harder. But on some smaller things around the margins. And, you know, I've had conversations with him where if we pulled together a group of us, if we started to build critical mass and had colleagues breaking bread together and realizing that, you know, no, Debbie Wasserman Schultz doesn't have three heads like, you know, all my right-wing, you know, supporters think she does. If they, you know, take a look and see that, you know, I'm just a normal person who's a mom and has the same challenges in my life that they do, and you get to know each other personally, I've found through all the years I've been in office that it is much harder to, you know, to fight against and be uncivil when you have gotten to know somebody personally. And so that's been my contribution to try to at least begin. And what we did in that dinner is we started out with five Republicans and five Democrats. And then each of us at subsequent dinners is responsible to bring a member of the opposite party with us to the next dinner. So we're up to about 40 members now. And they've become pretty popular. And people come away. I have Republican colleagues who sponsor legislation with me who I would never have asked, quite frankly, before because of what my impression of them was. And I'm certain that you know, they would have crossed the street before they came, before, you know, passing, working with me, before they attended. So, you know, we're working on it. It's really not rocket science. It's very simple. It's called, you know, just being a human being.
There's a gentleman off to our right.
Ms. Wasserman,
yes.
Listening to a young person like yourself, it really makes me feel there's hope for this country.
Thank you. thank you.
Having said that, here's the other shoe. No.
Okay,
no.
I'm ready.
Of course, we had the presidential election, and for the next two elections, Democratic Party appears to have dropped the ball in not getting out to vote the way we should have. What are your reflections on that, your thoughts?
I'm sorry, the next two elections?
The next elections after following the presidential election.
Oh, okay, you're talking about 2010, or are you talking about 2014 coming up? Well, let's not say we dropped the ball before the election even happens, my God. I can assure you...
No, the two secondary elections.
Okay, I can assure you that I fully intend to make sure that we have not dropped the ball, and when President Obama asked me to stay on and do a full four-year term as chair of the DNC, I succeeded, you know, my predecessor, Tim Kaine, and finished his unexpired term. You know, most DNC chairs, actually all of them, except Bob Strauss, who last did it in 1972, after they finish their term, kind of move on to the next thing. And so I'm the first DNC chair to stay past an election since 1972. Before that, it was 1932, which, you know, either means I'm a glutton for punishment, you know, or certifiably insane. I'm not sure which. But I really felt so strongly that balls had been dropped in midterm elections. That we, I think, in 2010, there's a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of analysis on what happened. Some people point to healthcare. I think it was probably much more so that we were still in the throes of trying to climb out and, you know, really kickstart the recovery. But, you know, people were frustrated, and so it was more than just that the Democratic Party, you know, we lost 63 seats in the House. We lost the majority of legislative chambers, and it, you know, there was a lot of work that we've done some soul searching over, that are mistakes that were made that I vowed we weren't going to make again, and so have you know, many of my Democratic colleagues. And so, if you look at you know, 2012, when we reelected Barack Obama president of the United States, and then fast forward a year after that, when most pundits were looking at whether or not we could replicate that ground game that we so effectively implemented to reelect the president. If you take a look at our successes in 2013, we really took the tools that we built, because we ran circles around the Republicans, in digital and our digital and technological advantage, in making sure that culturally, because our grassroots philosophy is embedded, you know, deep within neighborhood organizing teams in the Democratic Party, that we would be able to replicate it. And that's why Terry McAuliffe is governor of the state of Virginia, and we swept all three statewide offices for the first time in more than 20, you know, really more than 25 years. It's why we control all five statewide offices in Virginia. And, you know, what you've asked is a common perception, but really doesn't actually line up with reality. Name a single state, I defy you, to name a single state that is blue today, that is in danger of becoming purple and on its way to becoming red. Now I would ask you to take a look at the country and let's walk through the list of states that are red that we know we have an opportunity to turn purple and are on a way to being blue. A few years ago, if Ed and I had been on TV predicting that Nevada, Colorado, and Virginia would be reliably blue, we would have been laughed off the TV screen. And No, it's not. It's gubernatorial elections and municipal elections, and it's most definitely not just presidential elections. But I'm not going to debate. We're asking questions, so let me finish my answer, and then we can continue the discussion. So we've had some tremendous success. We also have to make sure that we continue to focus a sustained effort in midterm elections, and we've got to make sure that people who turned out for President Obama understand that it's imperative that they turn out as Democrats for our candidates in midterm elections. And that's what we're in the midst of organizing and continuing to make sure that we focus on leading into the midterms.
A few more questions. Yeah. Gentleman right here in the blue. And then there's somebody in the middle here in the blue also. Yeah, lady in the middle.
Congressman.
Yes.
Congressperson, excuse me. Sorry, I'll get hit next to me.
Debbie's easier.
Okay, Deb. I've spent a little time in local government politics, and one of the things that I've realized is that anytime you're defending policy, you're losing because you're playing
defending
on the other...
Defending policy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're working on the other guy's turf. You're exposed to his negative campaigns, and negative campaigning always works. How does the Democratic Party or the congressional majority in the Senate change the subject and start talking about a positive agenda for the future? Because without that, 2014 is problematic, because you're just going to hear a drumbeat of negative advertisement that is going to work, because you're defending policy.
Why don't we let her answer that question? Kim, do you want to grab the mic?
Negative campaigning, let me just disagree with your premise, doesn't always work. Especially because when you have two strong candidates running in just about any race, if they're both engaging in both positive and comparative or negative messages, then oftentimes it's canceled out. I mean, the strategy for most campaigns is supposed to be that you define yourself before you allow your opponent to define you. So in that sense, that's absolutely critical when it comes to the races that we're running across the country. You don't want to allow yourself to be defined, and you don't want the perception of policy issues to be baked into the cake so that you can't change the minds of voters or affect the minds of voters. I think, assuming that you're referring to healthcare reform, there's a big difference race by race when you are running and when you're communicating on the Affordable Care Act, whether you refer to it as Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act and as the healthcare reform law generally. And then when you go through and ask people, do you want to go back to the days when insurance companies were in the driver's seat and they could drop you or deny you coverage for a pre-existing condition? Do you want to kick your young adult children off their parents' insurance now that until they're 26 years old? Do seniors want to reopen the prescription drug coverage gap known as the donut hole and pay thousands more? The average senior in my district is saving $940 a year thanks to Obamacare closing the donut hole. I mean, I've stood online behind too many seniors who, when 5 or 6 prescriptions come to the counter, they have to leave 2 or 3 of them behind because they can't afford to take them all home. The people that I represent, the people in swing districts, I know my colleagues that represent swing districts, their constituents don't want to go back to those dark days. And that's the contrast that we have to draw between Republicans who have voted 51 times and counting to take away all those benefits and go back to a broken healthcare system, and Democrats who acknowledge that there might have been some problems, but as the next few weeks unfold, we'll see that we have a record number of people who have signed up for healthcare coverage that never had it before, and a record low in terms of the uninsured in this country. And I know that the people that I've spoken to all across this country don't want to go backwards. So that's how we're going to talk about it.
There's a lady in the middle in blue.
Right here. I'm right in the center. Sorry.
Oh, there you are. Sorry.
Can't stand.
Sorry, it's a little dark.
We're talking at a national level. I'm concerned about the state level. State level is where the electoral votes come. The state level with the census and all the gerrymandering that's been going on. How do we get past that? Obviously, we have to wait for the next census for one of that. But how do we get past that so that the state legislatures are as responsible to the public or as the public opinion as they should be?
Well, I'll give you an idea about how we did it and how we dealt with it in Florida. I mean, Florida is really a perfect example of a state in which, President Obama won it in 2008 and 2012. George W. Bush won it in the election in 2004. Sorry, I had to think about that. Clearly, we, you know, Al Gore won it in 2000. so let's just be clear about that. But in spite of that, in spite of Florida clearly being a purple state, we have an overwhelmingly Republican legislature. We have had for a long time a very lopsided congressional delegation. We have no Democratic statewide office holders. So the way Florida is represented is not reflective of our electorate. So the only thing the only bright spot for Democrats in 2010, the only bright spot I would say for Floridians in 2010, not just Democrats, was that there was an effort by a group called Fair Districts Florida, who clearly recognized that the gerrymandering that was so partisan and was driven by incumbent protection and partisan protection had to change. Now, in lots of states, there had been a movement to establish a commission that had been debated in Florida before, but it was really easy for the other for opponents of reform to say, you know what, even a commission is appointed by political, you know, by political people, and so there's no way to really make that process objective. So what they did was that they put two constitutional amendments on the ballot. They gathered the signatures, which it is very difficult to do in Florida. Then they ran the campaign, and you have to get 60% of the vote in order to pass a constitutional amendment in Florida. So that was challenging, too. And what they did was for congressional redistricting and legislative redistricting, they put three standards into the Constitution that the Florida legislature had to follow. They could not draw districts to protect an incumbent. They could not draw districts to protect a political party. And they had to respect municipal boundaries. So they couldn't chop up a city six ways from Sunday to give a sweet little piece of the pie to each, you know, to a particular incumbent legislator or a district, just to boost or to subtract from that from the partisan advantage of that party. And it passed in 2010 with 63% of the vote. That's how frustrated voters were with the gerrymandering and its impact. And as a result, we broke the supermajority in the 2012 election of Republicans, and so that gave the Democrats in the legislature the ability to make a difference during the legislative session. And they also had to, the governor had to take them seriously. It also forced two lawsuits, one of which is the congressional map coming up on May 19th, in which it's pretty clear that the Republicans drawing the district still violated those standards, but it gave people who wanted to fight for fair districts standing in court to file that lawsuit because there were standards in Florida's Constitution that the legislature had to be measured against. Now, not every state can amend their constitution that way. Some states have initiative. Some states can amend the Constitution. But that's a pathway to go around the legislature. And there's actually an organization that is focused on trying to, a 501c, C3 and 4, that's focused on trying to encourage similar movements across the country.
A few more questions. There's a lady in yellow or orange on this aisle, and a gentleman here about seven rows back.
The problem with financing, since the Supreme Court has decided that corporations are people and that the Koch brothers and Adelson can do whatever they please into the millions, how do you go about straightening that out now that the Supreme Court has put it down? And how can the Congress get something done to limit that kind of money that goes out to the too many people who already have a lot of money?
Citizens United, it's a really important question. You know, there's a reason. I agree with President Obama that Citizens United was one of the worst decisions handed down by the Supreme Court. You know, certainly when it comes to democracy and our ability to make a difference in our democracy, and handed over a lot of control over the outcome of elections to just a handful of very wealthy individuals. We believe, as Democrats in Congress, that's not appropriate, and that to the degree that we comply with the constitutional ruling from the Supreme Court, that we should change the law to try to make sure that we can reestablish the balance that we think is appropriate, where you significantly de-emphasize the influence of corporations and individuals who are willing to put in unlimited amounts of money. Now, it's a little awkward to talk about that in Pennsylvania because you don't have campaign finance limits here. So it's you were already experiencing that in a different way in Pennsylvania. So at the federal level, at the very least, we've filed legislation to make sure that there is transparency, because that Supreme Court case said that you can contribute an unlimited amount. You don't have to disclose it. You don't have to own up to it. There's no reporting. And so as a result, you have, and if you look at the 2010 election results, the congressional election results, a lot of the guys, those Tea Partiers who were elected, it wasn't that they were elected by their constituents. The corporate money that flowed through their campaigns went in to defeat the Democratic opponent, and you know, oftentimes the Democrat outraised and outspent in their own campaign the Republican, but the outside money came in and essentially bought the election, and that's really terrible for democracy, because who do you think those candidates, now members of Congress, are beholden to? You know, they know where that money came from, and it makes them less accountable to their constituents and the people they represent, and more accountable to the people who they want to keep that money flowing. The answer is to pass legislation to put reform in place to make sure that there's transparency, and there are a lot of different things that we can do, none of which the Republicans have any interest in doing, unfortunately. So we have to elect more Democrats. That's
final question here.
Actually, the last two people kind of took my question, so I'll ask you kind of a broader...
Nerve.
Yeah. So I'll ask you kind of a broader question, which is, one of the things that's really sad to me is a lot of people who are a little bit younger than I am were so excited by Barack Obama's election, you know, hope and change, and then the Republicans took over, and this is like basically the most conservative Republican Party, you know, of our lifetimes.
Oh, sure.
And it's so nihilistic and hateful and nasty, and there are these huge issues that you guys can't address. You know, you can't, it's not how are we going to address climate change. They don't even believe it's happening. What would you say to a young person, like, why shouldn't they be disillusioned? Why shouldn't they tune out?
So this question gives me the opportunity to kind of steer back more towards the book and why I wrote it. What I say to young people in the book, what I say to anybody, is you can make a difference, that you personally need to make a sacrifice. Get involved. You know, don't just cross your arms and sit back and complain. Make a difference and find the issue that matters the most to you, and figure out how you can get involved and make a difference on that issue, whether it's education or healthcare or gun safety or women's issues or climate change and global warming or the environment in general or energy and our investment in alternative energy. There's so many different issues that, you know, you can't just sit on the sidelines and expect other people to do it. And so right now, from my perspective, what I can see is that the most significant way, I don't want to say the only way, but the most significant way that we can make sure that we wake up some of the people in Washington who are not listening and who think that, you know, they are so entrenched and their power is, they're so dug in with the power that they have, the only way to wake them up is to make sure that their constituents get involved and go to those town hall meetings and mobilize and organize. And that's why, from our perspective as a party, we are continuing to organize and mobilize on the ground in a grassroots way, and putting together our neighborhood team leaders and knocking on doors and making phone calls and attending community meetings. I mean, activism, that's really the key. It's always been the key to making a difference. Change comes, and what the president talked about, from the ground up. We're a bottom-up party. The Republicans clearly are not a bottom-up party, but we are, and we need to continue that sustained momentum. What we saw between 2008 and 2010 is we took our foot off the gas pedal. People thought, okay, I've got a lot of problems with the, you know, the biggest recession that we were facing since the Great Depression. President Obama was elected. People were thrilled. They put a lot of stock in what in what he was going to be capable of doing, and we accomplished a lot. I mean, let's not forget that we did pass health care reform. We did. We've had 50 straight months of job growth in the private sector, and thanks to the Recovery Act and so much else that was the result of President Obama's leadership, we've climbed out of that recession and we're on the road to recovery. We've got improvements in housing and in job growth, and the private sector is now booming. The stock market is booming, but we also have a gap that is too wide between the haves and the have-nots, and that's why the president has dedicated a lot of his time to talking about closing that gap and making sure that people in America have an opportunity to climb those ladders to the middle class, while the Republicans clearly don't have any interest in helping people do that, you know, increasing the minimum wage, giving people a bridge through extension of unemployment insurance so that while they're struggling to still find work, they have an opportunity to make sure that they don't fall through the cracks. And it's so short-sighted not to extend unemployment insurance, because these are not people who are investing that money. They're not sitting on it. They're going to turn it right around and put it back into the economy and help us kick into an even more robust recovery. So that's what we all need to focus on. We need to stay engaged, and we need to, instead of sit on the sidelines and complain, we need to all figure out how we can, each of us individually, make a personal commitment to making a difference. That's what the book's about. Thank you.
That's it.
Okay. You want to take one more? No? Okay. Well, thank you all so much. I'm told by Andy that we are done for the evening, but it was such a privilege to be able to join all of you. Thank you for coming out on a Monday night. And thank you, Governor Rendell, for joining us as well.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.